What's going on? Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. It is heard live every day from noon to 3 on WBT Radio in Charlotte. And if you want exclusive content, like invitations to events, the weekly live stream, my daily show prep with all the links, become a patron, go to thepetecallinershow.com. Make sure you hit the subscribe button, get every episode for free, right to your smartphone or tablet. And again, thank you so much for your support. All right, so we're about 30 days away here from runoff election. There are a couple of them around the state, but some of the, I guess some of the rules here maybe or plans could be changing. I'm not really sure why. Kevin Lewis is a member of the State Board of Elections. Welcome to the program, sir. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you, sir, for having me.
Absolutely. So, first of all, can you tell me what... What is going on with the State Board of Elections and the Elections Director, Karen Brinson-Bell? There's some sort of a change in the timeline of when early voting plans are supposed to be established?
Yes, that's some news that has come out earlier this week. And it really doesn't affect the upcoming second primary, but historically... counties have met and approved their early voting plans by early August. And in fact, the state board advertises that as a best practice. They advertise that the early voting plans for the fall should be due on August 2nd. And now, all of a sudden, they want them to be about 3 months early. And so it's a little bit concerning.
So what are early voting plans? Let me start there.
Well, I can tell you, my background is I've been a member of the Nash County Board of Elections for about 16 years. I've only been on the state board for a little under a year. And what under the existing law, what the county boards do is they meet and they determine, how many different early voting locations do we need and how many can we afford to fund and what facilities are available and what hours do we need to operate them. And so the county will vote on a plan, and if it's a unanimous plan, then that will be the county's plan. But if it's a dispute and it's non-unanimous, then it falls to the state board to adopt a plan for that county.
Are those plans, does it normally go pretty smoothly? Are they usually unanimous? Do you know?
Well, for many years, in my experience, we were unanimous in my county, in Nash County. The last couple of elections, though, we did kind of hit a bump, and it all seems to boil down to whether or not you're going to have Sunday voting. Some of the other board members decided that it was going to be Sunday voting or not. We're not going to approve it without Sunday voting. And so we started having to go to the State Board of Elections. And, of course, the State Board of Elections made the decision for us.
All right. So now you've got the state telling these county boards of elections to draw up their plans 3 months earlier than they normally would. You mentioned that it's normally, in August that these things are done, but now, I guess, what is that, August, what, July,
now they wanted in early May.
Early May. So does that have any kind of impact as to when, the fiscal year begins? Is there any kind of problem with that timing?
Well, it could very well be the, of course, the county fiscal year starts generally July 1st, and so... Now counties are being asked to select locations and provide staff at these locations with money that they don't know if they're going to have or not. So that could be a problem.
What about isn't the makeup of the boards of elections changing? Aren't they changing?
That's a possibility. The legislature enacted... last year, a bipartisan board of elections. Right now we have a five-member board that is three members of the governor's party and then two members of the minority party.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a five-member board. Under the law that was enacted last year, it's going to be an eight-member board, which would be four members of each party. each of the two main parties, four Democrats and four Republicans. The courts have put that on hold, and it's my understanding that that's on appeal, and it'll be decided by our appellate courts, you know, sometime in the future. Now, whether that'll be decided, you know, in the next couple of months or 6 months from now, I don't know. But, yeah, that is something that's in the works.
So if I'm trying to kind of think through the timeline here, if they fast forward these early voting plans, they get to do it before any potential shakeup in the composition of the boards that might otherwise, alter the votes on those plans, right? I mean, like you said, I was going to say,
that seems like it could be.
Right, because I asked about whether or not the plans are, you know, normally unanimous. You said usually they are, but recently not so much, and it was over the Sunday voting. So if you have that same sort of a disagreement at a local level, but now the plans are forced into development 3 months earlier, now they would still, the Democrats would still control at the local level and at the state level, right, the adoption of those plans.
That is correct, and you know, there's some speculation as to that may be one of the reasons why they're trying to avoid what was previously a best practice and speed it up so that somebody can have an advantage.
No way. That would be that would be absolutely shocking to me.
Well, I hate to be cynical, because I think you know, to me, part of my job as a state board member, and I consider this to be part of my job when I was a county board member, is to promote, you know, confidence in the integrity of our election system. And so it is disappointing when actions are perceived to be partisan, when we really need to be either nonpartisan or bipartisan in administering elections.
Is there any other explanation, though, for why the plans would be pushed up 3 months? Why this action would be taken? Is there another alternative explanation that's been offered to you?
Not that has been offered to me, but you know, this has just come about, so maybe more will be revealed.
That's kind of odd, though, if there's not even sort of an explanation for the accelerated timeline when it was adopted.
Yeah, the board is meeting next week on another matter, so maybe, like I say, more will be revealed at that time.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay, is there anything else that you think is important or interesting on this that we haven't already covered that you want people to know?
No, I just want to say that I'm a strong believer that we have a great elections process in North Carolina. From my experience on the county level, I have great confidence in our personnel, and so, you really don't have to be, in my opinion, worried about are we doing what's best for the citizens in North Carolina.
Kevin Lewis, board member on the State Board of Elections. Thanks for your time, sir. We appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, sir. Have a good afternoon.
You too. Take care. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it. And that's Kevin Lewis. All right, so I want to make sure that you understand sort of the timing of this, and I'm just kind of figuring all of this out after talking to Mr. Lewis there from the State Board of Elections. The counties have to develop their early voting plans. The early voting plans are, right, what facilities are open, what days, the hours. Okay. So the counties put together the plans, they vote on them. If there's a disagreement, then it would go to the State Board for resolution. State Board of Elections is now telling the local boards, do your plans 3 months earlier than you normally do. And the cynic in me says the reason why they're doing that is to try to get in front of the Court of Appeals taking up this litigation over Senate Bill 749, which changes the composition of the State Board of Elections. Right, because think about it. If there's a plan from a county that changes the early voting days and hours, locations, whatever, and it's not agreed upon, then it gets kicked up to the state level. under the new law that's being litigated, under that new law, you could end up with a plan that does not meet Democrats' approval for whatever reason. And if it's the Sunday voting component or the hours or whatever, I don't know. But they want to be able to control essentially the verdicts on the local plans. And if the Court of Appeals rules that the state law, Senate Bill 749, if the Court of Appeals says, no, the law is fine, it can go into effect, then that means that Republicans might have a chance to affect the outcome on some of these local plan decisions. So rather than let Republicans have any kind of say in that outcome, in those verdicts, they're telling all of the local county boards to do it faster, do their plans faster, so this way they can rush through the approval process, and anything that gets challenged and goes to the state, the Democrat majority on the Board of Elections would still be able to control the outcome because they control the board. Whereas under the new state law, they would not control the board. It would be an even split. And if there's an even split, right, then I don't remember. It's been a while since I read the law. I forget what, I think there's a process there, but yeah, I forget. It may get kicked over to the General Assembly or something, but Democrats lose control over the rulings. And that's what they're trying to do an end run around right now. I mean, that's the obvious thing here, right? I mean, given Roy Cooper and Karen Brinson Bell and the Democrats, the lawyers, the activist crowd that keeps suing over all of this stuff, given their behavior over the last 4 years, at least, they don't get the benefit of the doubt from me anymore, at least. Not from me. So the fact that Mr. Lewis was not provided any kind of an explanation for why they're accelerating this timeline, that's odd. There's not even a cover story. And I didn't want to put him on the spot by saying it like that, but there isn't. There's no cover story here, is there? What's the cover story? Why do you need them 3 months earlier than normal? Except to try to get ahead of any kind of Court of Appeals ruling. To me, that's pretty obvious. But what do I know? Like, I'm just a little old radio host, you know? Just trying to make my way in the world. Okay, if you're listening to this podcast, you are obviously paying attention to the world around us. You also have really great taste, I might add. But if you haven't started getting prepared for various emergencies, I gotta ask, what are you waiting for? Please call my friends Bill and Jan at Carolina Readiness Supply, and they'll help get you started. If you have no idea how to start, they can help you. If you're an experienced prepper, they can help you too. Being prepared is just smart. We've already established that you're smart. I mean, you listen to this podcast after all. So let's put those smarts into action. Go to CarolinaReadiness.com. That's CarolinaReadiness.com or call them at 828-226-7239. Carolina Readiness Supply has 2,000 square feet of supplies as well as educational materials that you're going to need for any kind of emergency. Veteran-owned Carolina Readiness Supply. Will you be ready when the lights go out? Along the lines of the election, this piece was published about 2 weeks ago, actually, by Laura Leslie at WRAL, leftist mouthpiece that outlet is. More than 1,600 ballots were thrown out in the March 5th primary. See, when you just say it like that, obviously with the soundbite too, it makes it sound terrible. 1,600 ballots were thrown out. Oh, disenfranchisement, right? Suppression. This was the, I don't know why I go Fiddler on the Roof with that. I don't even remember the play. All right. This was the first statewide election since 2014 to require voter ID due to a court ruling that enacted the law after a long legal battle, which is, so, okay. This is a very awkwardly written sentence. Laura Leslie has been a journalismer for a very long time, like decades, okay? You can't tell me that you haven't figured out how to write this kind of a sentence, right? the first statewide election since 2014 to require voter ID after court allowed it to stay in place, court allowed the law to take effect or whatever. But no, she's going to say due to a court ruling that enacted the law. Well, the court ruling did not enact the law. The legislature enacted the law, right? The court ruling blocked it and then stopped blocking it. That's right. The enacting of the law is not what the court does, okay? Anyway, as well as the first to implement a tighter deadline for mail-in ballots, right? So this was the outrage last time around because the Republican legislature said, hey, you know what? For a long time, the absentee ballots were supposed to be, we didn't count them if they arrived after Election Day. And then at some point along the line, a couple of years ago, they changed the rules to allow for absentee ballots, mail-in ballots to be counted even if they arrived after Election Day, but as long as they were postmarked before Election Day or on Election Day, right? As long as they had a postmark that got them, you know, the postmark was Election Day or earlier, then we counted them. But that meant that you had these days after the election where ballots were still coming in and vote totals were still being changed. And so they said, you know what, it doesn't help instill confidence in the system. So why don't we go ahead and go back to the way it was, which was the votes have to be at the Board of Elections by the close of the polls on Election Day so they can be counted with all of the other ballots. And outrage ensued. Suppression, suppression. There it is again. How dare you? Right? Of course, they never want to. And the people who were opposed to this going back to the way it was, the change, in other words, Democrats and media, but I repeat myself, those proponents or opponents, I guess they would be, they never talked about the most recent example of why the postmarks present problems, which was Sherry Beasley, not her Senate run that she lost, but her reelection to the state Supreme Court that she also lost. But she lost that one by very few votes, like several hundred votes out of, you know, I think a couple hundred thousand that were cast, maybe even more than a million. I forget what the vote totals were, but it was a very close race. Paul Newby beat her by several hundred votes, and it came down to what votes they were going to count in certain districts and counties, and she had filed, you know, some petitions in certain counties. He filed petitions in other counties, whatever. And one of the arguments that her lawyers made was that these ballots had arrived and some of them did not have postmarks that were distinguishable. And her lawyers said it really doesn't matter as long as they got there. Right? So this is how they do you, right? Like, this is why you can't trust these lawyers. And, you know, when they're making these arguments about, oh, you know, we want to be able to make sure everybody's vote counts, not everybody's vote, but, you know, the votes we like, we want those to count. And when you outline a standard that says we want the postmarks to control, right? We want postmarks on these ballots. That'll be the controlling standard. But then when push comes to shove, and you're within a couple hundred votes that you're trying to find in a couple counties, now you want to just ignore that controlling standard. Now it's not a controlling standard anymore, right? Now it's like, well, you know, the post office just must have forgotten to stamp that batch or something, right? They start figuring out all these ways to make excuses for why the controlling standard that they wanted in place now shouldn't be the controlling standard, which is why, like, again, given what I've seen of your behavior over the past decade now, since y'all lost control, you have not handled it well in North Carolina. You Democrats and media, but I repeat myself, you have not handled it well since Republicans took control of the state legislature in 2010. So because I've been watching that, I don't believe you. Okay? When you make these arguments, I don't believe you. I don't think you're arguing in good faith. Now, you can say that the Republicans are not either. Okay. You can make that argument all day. I'm making the argument that you're not arguing in good faith. There you go. So we're even. Okay. Until 2023, mail-in ballots in North Carolina that were postmarked by Election Day were accepted via mail delivery until the following Friday, 3 days later. The grace period was intended to offset possible delays in mail processing. But in 2023, last year, Republican state lawmakers authored several changes to election laws in the name of election integrity. One of those changes did away with the three-day grace period, setting 7:30 p.m. on election day as the new deadline. Okay, so this last election, the primary that we just went through, this was the first time we did an election with these rules, right? We had the voter ID and we had the 7:30 deadline on election day. According to data from the State Board of Elections, 1,100 ballots were rejected in the primary because they were received after that deadline. That is an increase of 324 over the 2020 primary. So 2020, there were 800 ballots that got rejected because they arrived after the grace period, which was three extra days. Right? So wait a minute. Okay, so right, so you had three extra days after the election to get your ballot in, and then there were 800 after those were rejected. So people were still, so how many came in the three-day grace period? That's what I would like to know. How many ballots came in during that three-day grace period? Is it somewhere in the neighborhood of about 300? Because that would put you at about the same number, would it not? Brent Woodcox, one of the staffers for Senate Leader Phil Berger, he's with the Berger camp, but he's a lawyer and he does some work for the Senate on the Republican side, Senate leadership. And, he framed it as 99.9% of all ballots were accepted. And that's true, too, right? The vast majority of the ballots, 99.99% of them, were accepted. No problem whatsoever. There were millions of ballots cast, and this is 1,600 that were rejected for problems. They could not cure, quote-unquote, the problems. See, it's all in how you spin it. Thank you for the emails and the phone calls. We were looking it up during the break. We found out where the vice president is appearing. It is at the Naomi Drennan Center. It is off Wendover Road. What's amazing is I lived over there for like about 5 years, never knew it was there. I had no idea there was a park over there. If you're going down Wendover Road, it's before the Home Depot and the Restore, before you get to Monroe Road. It's on the right-hand side, same side of the road as the Home Depot is on. And there's like that apartment complex that's right there. There's like apparently some park that's back there too. And there's a rec center. There's a skateboard park. And so I guess she's going to be doing some ollies or something at the skateboard park. It's past Randolph Road and before Monroe Road. There you go. Let me see here. Over. Leave it to a leftist not to know that the courts don't enact laws. That's that's true. So get this, over half of Gen Z diners don't think that, so that's not like a place. It's not like Gen Z restaurants. It's Gen Zs who are dining. Okay. Over half of Gen Z people who are dining do not think that table etiquette is relevant anymore. This, according to a survey by a restaurant group called Prezzo. The survey, I believe out of Britain, found that 77% of Gen Z diners do not care if people put their elbows on the table. I got to tell you, I'm kind of a Gen Z at heart on this one. It really does not matter to me. It doesn't bother me. In fact, sometimes it's essential if you're eating like a very large sandwich. Right? And the tables are low. I think this matters too. You know, there's a whole science behind table heights, chair heights, all sorts of, because, I mean, think about it. You go to a fast food joint and the tables and chairs are not very comfortable. Why? They don't want you hanging out there. You're just going to cause trouble, right? So get your food, eat it, get out. That's right. But now if you go to a fancier place, right, comfortable chairs, higher backs, higher table, that kind of thing. So it's harder to get your elbows up onto that table. So 60%, though, couldn't care less about how somebody holds their silverware. I'm not a big, I don't watch people on that one. Half of the British diners asked said they are upset about the lack of table manners, though. So half of the people are like, oh, this angers me. Yet on the other hand, like, a lot of them don't care about their own table manners, which is, I think, part of the problem. 49% of people asked say that they would not date somebody who had bad table manners. 48% of people were irked by loud chewing. Yeah. Yeah. That's, yeah. 37% are annoyed when people use their food at the table. I guess play with their food. I'm one of them. Not that I play with my food. I get annoyed with people who do that. Yeah. Especially children. Oh, my gosh. They're always playing. And another 37% hated when people ate off of other people's plates without asking. I think that's different. If it's your spouse or significant other or whatever, I have no problem with that. Now, if I'm not related to you or I didn't marry you, I take it back. If I didn't marry you or you're not my child, you don't eat off my plate. Actually, I take it back. Only Christy gets to eat off my plate. That's it. There's nobody else that would, like, you're going to get a fork in your hand, you know? More than half of survey participants also hated it when people talk with food in their mouths. Yeah, that I do not like that either. Or if they're very loud. Yeah, I'm one of those too. I think apparently I get annoyed at a lot of people's table behavior. And then there's this, people who snap their fingers at servers. Who the hell does that? Who does that anymore? My God. Like, that's same people who leave their shopping carts outside the corrals in the parking lot, probably. All right, that'll do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. I could not do the show without your support and the support of the businesses that advertise on the podcast. So if you'd like, please support them too and tell them you heard it here. You can also become a patron at my Patreon page or go to thepetecallinershow.com. Again, thank you so much for listening, and don't break anything while I'm gone.